Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to be an elementary school teacher? Besides a good education, boundless patience, and a rock-solid immune system, veteran teacher Philip Doan has learned that it also requires a knowledge of Pokemon cards and of the signs that an 8-year-old is about to throw up. It takes an understanding of the vagaries of kids' spelling, a tolerance for noise and for getting whacked by the occasional dodgeball, and the optimism and energy to get up the morning after a very tough day and do it all over again. His new book, which chronicles a single year with his Mountain View, California class, is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. Phil, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You write that we might forget what our individual teachers taught us, but that we never forget how they made us feel. And that is an awesome responsibility.
Yes, you're absolutely right. If you recall the teachers that you've had or you had when you were a child, you know, you really only remember a handful. I can only remember probably 3 or 4 or 5 if somebody asks me who those teachers were who are etched in your mind as superb. And it's because they were so caring and committed. When I think about the qualities of these teachers that I remember, it's the ones who valued me.
What do you remember about your own third grade teacher?
Oh, I was absolutely in love with my third grade teacher. I had her for second grade and third grade. In fact, that's one of the reasons I think I wanted to become a teacher was because of how much I loved her. She was a little old lady. Her name was Miss Greco, and I used to go into my older brother's closet and pull out his hand-me-down suits and ties, and gel my hair with dippity-doo, and sit there just perfectly still with my hands crossed at my desk, just waiting for her to tell me how nice I looked because I had a crush on her, and she always did. She always did. She was also, I thought she was magic because during silent reading time, lots of teachers have silent reading time after lunch. While all the kids were sitting there reading, I would look over the top of my book and stare at her while she sat in the front of the room preparing an art project that we'd be doing the next day or later on. And I would just stare at her and watch her as she converted these egg cartons into bumblebees and baby food jars into Mother's Day presents. You know, she showed me how to create. She showed me what the thinking looked like. I was just in love with her.
What do you find appealing about third graders specifically? And how are they different from, say, second graders or fourth graders?
Well, third grade is the magic age. They can do so much more than the first and the second graders. You know, the first graders, you're teaching them how to read. Second graders, you're still reinforcing the skills. The second graders still don't even know if the holes on the binder paper go on the left or the right. You're still showing them how to hold a pencil. But by third grade, pretty much they can read, and you're moving from the skills to now the concepts. So you're still doing reinforcement of the skills, but they can just do so much more. But what I love about third grade is it's just the precious age. They get excited when you bring in a fossil or a magnet, and they're little sponges. They love everything. They get excited about everything, and it doesn't hurt that they still love the teacher.
Yeah, they unabashedly love the teacher, which is sort of nice.
Yes. Absolutely love the teacher, and that continues into fourth grade too, which is fourth grade's a precious age too. Come fifth grade, they start to change a bit. You know, now it becomes more important what their peers think of them than their teacher.
Phil, a recurring theme throughout the book is how much you love school supplies. What is the appeal for you?
I think all elementary school teachers have this passion for school supplies. In fact, come summer, you make your annual trip to Walmart or Target to open up those new boxes of crayons and markers. And I think that may, in fact, I've never thought about this before, that may be one of the reasons I wanted to go into teaching. You know, every year as a student, you buy your new school supplies, right? Your pencils and your binders and your folders. And maybe that was part of the lure of getting me into the classroom, because every year you get your boxes of new school supplies for your kids.
I guess nowadays there's also the requisite hand sanitizer. Does that kind of creep you out, having to worry about all that more than we did when we were kids?
Yeah, I never was into it. In fact, we've gotten it now in our boxes at the beginning of the year for a couple of years now. You know, before it was just Kleenex, and then you'd get the bottles of hand sanitizer as well. And now they're requiring the kids to come in, wash their hands after every recess, and even when they go out to recess, wash their hands. I mean, yeah, I never got into the hand sanitizer, but now, you know, we're required to use it more and more.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you feel on the first day of school?
Oh, yes. The first day of school, actually the night before the first day of school, I still get the butterflies. Even though I have been doing this for 25 years, I've been teaching now for 25 years in public schools, I think a lot of teachers get the butterflies the night before, because really teaching is really the best stage in town. And I look at it as though you're about to go on stage. It's opening night the following day. And you want to do the best job you can. You know you're going to meet all those new children and their parents. And that first day is so important. It's the most important day of the year. You know, those kids are either going to go home and say, "Mommy, I love my new teacher," or they're going to say, "I didn't have a very good day." So, yeah, I always get nervous, get butterflies the night before. But you meet your new kids, and you fall in love with your new kids, and everything always works out great.
And you have developed certain ways of sizing them up early on to try and figure out what exactly you have to deal with when each new school year starts.
Yes. In my book, and some of it's tongue-in-cheek, I talk about the tests that teachers give to kind of size those kids up. And, you know, there are lots of different... Oh, well, one of them I call the second-grade teacher test, kind of where you go to the second-grade teachers and you ask them about the kids and you know, if they roll their eyes or shake their heads or ask you, you know, if you know you're on antidepressants or something, then you know you got a doozy coming up.
What do you do about the kids that for whatever reason just sort of rub you the wrong way?
It's funny. Those kids that can really try you often end up being your most favorite at the end of the year. It's really interesting. Though, you know, the kids who just take so much energy require a lot of energy from you, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons that you end up just loving. I mean, you love all your kids, but you just really find those kids to be special. Like, seriously, some of the ones you just want to tear your hair out over, and the ones I say give me gray hair, are the ones by the end of the year or even a lot earlier, you just end up having a real special place in your heart for.
So how much do your lesson plans change from one year to the next? Like, I guess you're maybe always refining certain things, and then other things probably once you've got them down, they stay.
Yes. And that can depend on if you stay in the same grade level. Some teachers move. Like, I've taught third grade and then fourth grade and then fifth grade and then back to third and then to fourth. And so if you move grade levels, your lesson plans are going to change. But if you stay in the same grade level, and hopefully if you're hired as a new teacher, you'll get a couple of years in that same grade level and not be bounced around so that you can really kind of refine your craft. But what I try to do is, sure, I have my standard lessons that I do every year, but what I also try purposefully to do is to try new lessons every year. Okay, I haven't tried this writing activity. I'd like to do this, because that keeps you fresh. You don't want to get stale and just do the same things year after year after year. And also, curriculum changes. School districts adopt new math programs or new writing programs or new spelling programs, so you're also forced to change your lessons.
Is that just a nightmare when the principal calls or you go to some teacher in service and you're told, guess what, we're starting a brand new math program next year?
To be honest, yes, because you may really like the math program. In fact, that just happened in our district at the end of last year. Generally, every 7 years here in California where I teach, the new math programs come through, and a school district can either adopt it or not. Well, they adopted the new math program. And yes, you get used to the program you're using. You get used to the materials that come with it. You become very comfortable with it, and so it's starting all over again. And I think that's something that parents don't really think about, how, you know, a teacher can't sit there and do the same lesson for 30 years because new programs are coming through every couple of years.
You mentioned earlier that kids at this age really can read and write, and they can do a lot for themselves. It must be fun to read some of their compositions and the things that they write to you in long form.
Oh, that is one of the best parts of the job in this grade, when you have them at third and fourth grade, because what they write is so cute. It's just darling. You know, sometimes they're so precious, like a Valentine card they've written or a thank you card. I have to pull the mom in and say, hey, you're not supposed to see this until you get it for Valentine's Day, but I just have to show you. Yeah, they're darling. Children, third graders generally love to write, and they love to write stories, and they love to write narratives, and yes, what they write is absolutely precious. You know, I had a little kid. He wrote a little card to his mom for Mother's Day back in May, and he said, you know, I've loved you since the day I was born. And I thought, you know, that's so precious.
And you've also performed some interventions. You had a kid come to you and say, I'm going to test and see if the tooth fairy's real.
Oh, yes. In fact, children at this age, 8 and 9-year-olds, really believe in the tooth fairy. One year I asked them all, I just pulled them out at recess when I was at the yard duty. I said, do you believe in the tooth fairy? And 90% of those kids believed in the tooth fairy. It's amazing. More kids believe in the tooth fairy than Santa Claus. And they'll, of course, always ask you. So, you know, Mr. Doan, is the tooth fairy true? Is the tooth fairy true? And, you know, you always say yes. And one girl, her name was Alicia, and she came to me and she said, I'm going to test my parents and see if the tooth fairy's true. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, I lost my tooth at school, and I'm not going to tell my parents. And if I don't have something under my pillow, it's because I didn't tell them, so I know it's not true. So what I did at the end of the day, or I think it was even at lunch recess, I called the girl's mom, and I told her. So, you know, good for another year.
There are also, of course, the kids that you worry about. And you write here about a little girl who was having a tough time learning to read as fluently and fluidly as the rest of her class.
Yes. And you always have, well, you have a broad range of students every year, and some who are just top readers and your average readers, and your readers who are struggling as well. Generally, when they make up a class, they try to make it a heterogeneous group. And I did have one girl. She really was struggling in reading and didn't want to read aloud, didn't want to take risks. And we had a dog at our school who had trained for the seeing program where they help blind people. And the secretary used to bring this dog in. And I thought, oh, my goodness, why don't I have this girl go after lunch and read to the dog. It won't be threatening to her at all. And we worked a program out where she went to the office after lunch when it was quiet, not a lot of distraction, and she would read to this dog. And that turned this child around. She used to be very tardy. She used to come to school late. If she, you know, she would be sick, she'd have a lot of social problems with the other kids. But when she knew that she could go read to this dog, she just turned around.
What I love about the story, too, is that when she was finally ready to read aloud to the class, they all sort of held their breath and nobody snickered. And I'm guessing she still stumbled more than the other kids, but they were sort of pulling for her.
Absolutely. And you bring up a very good point. Yes, she did read very slowly and haltingly. Finally, she decided to take the risk and read aloud. I wouldn't even call on her. You know, generally, I don't force kids to, of course, but she had raised her hand very reluctantly and wanted to volunteer to read to the class, and I was stunned. And yes, you're right. The other kids, you could feel that they were rooting for her. And children know. Children really get it. They understand when one of their peers is taking a risk. They want you to do well. And it was a beautiful, beautiful feeling because you could just feel 25 kids rooting for their classmates.
Teacher and writer Philip Doan is my guest. His new book is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. We'll resume our conversation with Phil in just a moment and welcome you to join us now by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Teacher and writer Philip Doan is my guest. His newest book is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Phil, this book looks back on one particular year. I'm wondering if the classes that you have taught tend to stay separate in your mind as you look back on your career.
I think more so than the classes that kind of stay separate in my mind, I kind of think back on those classes as far as certain key children. Over 25 years, the classes kind of run together, but you certainly remember the years by the children. And what I mean by that is, you know how the Chinese calendar has the year of the snake and the monkey and the rat and so forth? That's really how I remember my years, too. I had the year of Samantha and the year of Andrew, and last year was the year of Giovanna. And you remember key students that you've had, like my my first year was the year of Samantha. I remember that. She was a writer. She loved to write, but she didn't just like to write on her paper. She loved to write all over her body. She would take a red magic marker and draw a watch on her wrist with red magic marker, and then beg me to ask her what time it was, like three or four times during the day. And I didn't always want to play. And so you remember these students, or I had another one, the year of Andrew. Oh, this is a cute story. So in third grade, you teach them how to tell time, and I had my big yellow clock that all elementary teachers have. It's called the Judy clock, and Big Hand was on the – I had the kids gathered around me on the carpet and was showing them how to tell time, and the Big Hand was on the 12, and the Little Hand was on the 5, and I asked if anybody knew what time it was, and Andrew raised his hand and shouted, "It's happy hour." So, you remember years by key children.
You, in this year that you write about, you had a student who was struggling with leukemia. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Oh, yes. That was a tragic experience. I had a student named Michael, who I called Angel. Even before I found out he was sick, he picked up the nickname Angel, I think because he wanted to be a pastor when he grew up. And I remember once early on, I was trying to make a connection with him, I knew he went to church every Sunday. I said, "Oh, wasn't there an angel named Michael?" And he goes, "Yeah." And so the name Angel stuck. He would even sign it on his papers. Well, a couple of months into the school year, the mom comes in and tells me that Michael has leukemia. And at the first, couple of weeks after that, it didn't seem like he was ill at all. And then finally, with the treatments and the chemo, he lost his hair, and then he got weaker, and eventually he couldn't come to school. And he died that year, at the end of the year. And it was tragic for us. But one of the most moving parts of that experience was Michael would call me from the hospital when he was getting treatments and had to stay overnight. And we would talk, and I would sing to him, and he would sing to me. He was a very musical child. And during the school year, I taught him a lot of songs. I taught all the kids a lot of songs. And one of the songs that I had taught him was Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and several songs from The Wizard of Oz. He didn't know The Wizard of Oz. And then at the service for his, at his memorial service at the church, which was packed, I found out that this little boy had actually written his own service. He was that kind of kid. He knew he was going. And he had planned his own service. And after I spoke, he had invited me to speak. I sat down, and all of a sudden, I hear this noise from the choir loft, and the choir begins singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Hmm.
And I knew that this boy had planned that piece because I taught it to him. Very moving.
Yeah. How do you help the class deal with something like this as it's going on?
Well, as I said, when it first was going on, you really didn't know. He would get up there with his little red and white blood cell stuffed animals that the doctors had given him and talk about it. But when he looked fine, you didn't really have to comfort the class because he just seemed fine. And then then when he was gone more and more, you had to explain because they'd ask about him. And I decided to take the honest approach. If I visited him in the hospital, which I did about once a week, I'd come back and give the update. And then finally, when it occurred, I believe that the room moms had actually contacted the families before the next day of school to let the families know. I know that when the day after at school, I didn't have to make the announcement for the first time. The children had heard it from their parents already, which helped.
Yeah.
However, after he died, I had a dilemma. What do I do with his desk?
You leave everything there.
Yeah. Do I leave the desk? Do I leave the name tag? What do I do? And I decided I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave it, and I'm going to keep his presence alive in the classroom. We're going to talk about him freely. He was a real asset to that room. I mean, he had a real presence, and he just sparkled, and he loved to pick those songs every week, and he loved the Star Spangled Banner. We had to sing that whenever he was the song monitor. So, you know, what happened was, you know, and I'm glad I took this approach, we talked about it when we needed to, and when it was cute, when other song monitors would pick the Star Spangled Banner, we just ended up calling it Michael's song. Hmm.
Philip Doan is my guest. His new book is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Michael in Crum. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi, my wife's a third grade teacher, so I'm intricately involved with elementary school teaching. I just wanted to say how hard these people work and how it's really a labor of love. If they didn't love the kids and love what they're doing, they simply wouldn't be there, because the pay is inadequate and the job's really tough.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. It's nice to get the validation. And good luck to your wife. I mean, this is a busy time of year right now. Has she started her parent-teacher conferences yet, or is it just about to?
Yes, they've done two already. So yeah, she's waiting for midterms. And she's been in third grade about 5 years. She's done first, kindergarten. Down in Texas, you know, it was double sessions of kindergarten a day, so that's 50 kids a day to deal with. And how they do it, I don't know. It's just really tough. But third grades are just a wonderful age. 9 and 10 year olds are so much fun.
I agree. Thanks for your call.
How do you unwind at night when you go home? Because I guess you've still got papers to grade and things to do once you're at your house.
Right. Now, what most teachers do, I don't know if I should say this, but you kind of crash when you go home if you've really given it your all during the day, because really it's like being on stage for 6 hours. You don't go home hyped, like you need to come down or unwind. You really just kind of crash for a little bit. At least I do.
You need to collapse.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, after your break, you know, then, okay, you can make dinner and clean the house a little bit and sit in front of TV and grade papers. But most of us, honestly, if I were honest about it, go home and just crash.
We have an email here from Anna who asks what you think about alternatively certified teachers, whether you think alternative certification versus regular certification is better, one or the other, and how states might better streamline those programs.
You know, I don't know too much about the alternative certifications. And the certification programs, probably best if I don't answer it too directly, because I'm familiar with the California system. That's where I have my credential. And they vary from state to state to state so much that I know that somebody from another state coming to California might have to take a lot more classes. So it's hard for me to speak to that issue.
There is a really interesting glimpse in the book, I think, into the kind of mentoring that you as teachers do for one another. There's always someone less experienced on the block and someone who's been there forever.
Absolutely. And if you've been in the profession for, you know, I would say about 10 years or more, you will get approached by your principal to mentor a student teacher. And all prospective teachers have to go through a student teaching program, and that's not just in California, that's everywhere. And this student teacher is assigned to your school, And that's where you really learn your trade, because most of what you learn in school is philosophy. And then where you learn more of the practical is when you're out in the trenches, in the real school. But not only student teachers, new teachers that come in, you know, that are hired are or should be and are often attached to a buddy teacher, a mentor teacher on site, somebody that they can go to and you know, cry on and, and you know, share their stresses and their frustrations with. And so that's a really important job of the veteran teacher. You're not just taking care of those kids and the parents. You are also looking out for the new teachers because, it, as the gentleman caller just said, you know, it is tough. You're in the trenches, and there's nothing that can train you for that first year, first week of school. You know, you really need a fantastic mentor teacher to get you through the first couple of weeks in your first year.
Have you developed a system for sort of sizing up new teachers in the same way that you try to size up your new students when they come in?
Well, the new teachers that have come in at our school have often been student teachers. If you're a student teacher in a district, you have a better chance of getting hired. So I've known several of these people as student teachers and thus have had more time with them. And one way that you really size up, I can tell if somebody's going to be good, is by the questions they ask. And if they ask a lot of questions, I'm very impressed by that. If somebody comes into my room with a pad and paper, and say for an observation, and then sticks around and asks me a 100 questions, why did you do this? Why did you talk to this child this way? Why did you hang this art project there? Why didn't you answer this child's question when, you know, you were talking, blah, 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 blah? It shows, okay, this person's going to be all right. This person knows, this person wants to be a great teacher.
One of the cool things that you do with your kids is, you know, they have the requisite report on a famous person in history, and you have them do a wax museum. Can you talk about that?
Yes. We do a wax museum every year, and it's a big hit at our school, and I know lots of other teachers do it, too. It's not my own idea. And that is when you're studying biographies, and a lot of teachers will study biographies where the children read a biography of their choice and then write something about that. Well, what my kids do and what we do with all the third graders at my school is the children read a biography, say, of Abraham Lincoln or Amelia Earhart or, you know, Louis Armstrong, whoever they want. And then they, after they've written a little report about this person, they dress up like the character. And we have this huge living wax museum. And they have practiced their speech, and they're going to give a 2 to 3 minute speech as though they are that person. And what happens is the children all stand like wax figures, just like Madame Tussauds, and the other classes come in, and there's a green button and a red button and on their shoulders, just a piece of construction paper, a round piece of construction paper. And if somebody from another class touches the green button, then they start talking about their lives. And they touch the red button, and then they stop. And the children love it. The other classes love it. You know, then they get to freeze in their funny positions when somebody touches the red button. But it's a great way to reinforce what they've learned. And I've had Shirley Temple to... You know, Annie, get your gun. I had them all at the wax museum.
And you write that there's always somebody who wants to write a report about, like, Spider-Man, and you have to put the kibosh on
Yes,
them.
Yes. Oh, yes. You know, every year one wants to be the Hulk or Superman, and you have to explain, well, you know, that's not really the kind of person I have. Yes, they're famous, but let's go for a more classic historical figure. And so, yeah, every year some wise guy always wants to be Spider-Man, you're right.
How, Phil, does your workday and your job description change when you head out and take on the dreaded playground duty?
Oh, my goodness. You know, every teacher will tell you that the thing they hate the most, probably next to parent-teacher conferences and writing report cards, and I shouldn't say that I hate parent-teacher conferences, it's just a lot of work, would be yard duty. recess duty, yard duty. It's actually called different things across the country, which I find interesting. And well, imagine you've been teaching from 8 to 10, generally, in the morning, and then you have to go out for yard duty. Usually you're on a rotating schedule. And you get no break. You absolutely get no break because then you have to come back in and teach for another hour and 45 minutes till lunch. You have no break to use the restroom. And you're out there with maybe 3 or 4 other teachers and 400 to 500 children, and it's chaos. It's just craziness. And one of the worst parts is getting hit in the head. You know, these balls are flying everywhere. And you have to be in a station. You can't just hide as a yard duty. You're in a designated spot. And if you have blacktop duty, you really have to watch out. Because basketballs, volleyballs, tether balls, red rubber balls are flying.
And a lot of the kids want to make constant contact with you when you're out there.
Oh, constantly.
Well.
Oh, absolutely. You're surrounded, generally, but you're surrounded by second and third and fourth grade kids, and usually the girls, and they just want to come and talk. And I think part of it is, and this makes sense, you know, during the class time, you're not going to socialize with these kids. You know, you're doing whatever lessons you're supposed to be doing. And so this is a time when you can kind of let down, and they can come and be more social and ask you about, you know, something or other. And I think that's one of the reasons they do it, is it's a good connecting time. And teachers out on yard duty know that. In fact, when there are children who need that connection to the teacher, you seek them out, especially some of the loners. You know, you'll go up to them if they're just sitting alone and establish that connection because, you know, let's face it, the good teachers know it's all about connection.
It's got to be interesting to observe the kids sort of in the wild from a distance and how they interact with one another.
Oh, yes. And sometimes you just look at these kids. You know, you might have, you know, 5 fifth-grade boys, you know, down, squatted on the ground with their T-shirts spread over their knees, you know, just hopping around on the ground like they're little midgets, you know, or pretending they're ducks. I mean, it's just amazing. You just kind of drop your jaw and roll your eyes. or they're playing sumo. You know, a lot of them like to put red rubber balls under their shirts and just bang into each other like bumper cars. And it's constant. I mean, you can't believe some of the things they come up with.
Philip Doan is with us. He's a teacher and a writer. His newest book is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is teacher and writer Philip Doan. His new book is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Phil, you write that there's no faster way to quiet down a class of third graders than accepting a cell phone call in the middle of class. Suddenly they all want to hear.
Oh, yes. You know, I try to keep that cell phone off, but sometimes I'll forget. And most people don't try to call me during the school day because they know I'm teaching. But once in a while, that cell phone will go off. And if it's maybe a repairman that I have to talk to or something, yeah, I'll pick it up. And you're absolutely right. There is a hush. It's like a pin. You could hear a pin drop in that room because they want to know what you're talking about. Also, you know, if they're nearby and say it's recess and you're emailing somebody, they will stand over you and read that email. The reason why is they're so interested in your life as a teacher, and I really believe this. The children want to know about you as a real person. You know, you're the teacher, and it's at those moments when you're real and when you open up that you get closer to them. And so that's why purposefully I will stop once in a while and tell them a story. Tell them a story about my life or when I was their age or about my pets when I was a kid because I know they're longing to know about me. And they say that, you know, if the kids have that connection with you, and that's how you make that connection, they're more apt to produce for you and also believe in what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, I do remember being a kid, and there was nothing more remarkable than seeing a teacher, like, at a restaurant or in the grocery store or something.
Yes. Oh, yes. And I teach in my hometown, so I run into kids a lot. And, in fact, because I've been teaching so long, I run into students that I had maybe 25 years ago. Now, imagine, I had them when they were 10 or younger, and now they're in their 30s. And when they come up to you, inevitably, they will just say, "Hi, Mr. Doan." And they don't introduce themselves. They won't say their name because they assume you know who they are.
Well,
you look the same, maybe have a little more gray hair, yes. But so what you have to do is you have to go through that Rolodex in your head really fast and try to remember this kid who vaguely looked like somebody you taught 20 years ago. And usually, I'm not great with names, but usually I can place the child in the classroom. Now, if you've just had them in the last couple of years, then it's not a problem. And it's funny, I have a theory about this. If you run into a child at the supermarket, you may have the chattiest child in class, the one who will just never be quiet. But when they run into you on Saturday morning at the supermarket, they generally don't speak because they're so shocked to see you, especially if you haven't shaved.
You're not in your regular uniform of school clothes.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And the moms will stand there and go, "Honey, come on, this is your teacher. Say hello. Don't be rude. Why aren't you talking?" And I always just say to the moms, "Oh, this is normal." when they run into me in the supermarket Saturday morning, they never speak.
Is it strange to have like a 35-year-old former student calling you Mr. Doan, or have you gotten so used to being addressed that way that it doesn't even faze you?
I've gotten so used to it that now I don't stop and say, "Oh, just call me Phil." However, once in a while, now that I've reconnected with lots of former students on Facebook, a former student will write and say, "Is it okay if I call you by your first name, Phil?" I'm like, "Absolutely, please do." But most will say, probably 90%, "I could never call you." And I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I taught with colleagues of mine. There's no way. Even if they tell me, "Please call me Audrey or Susan," there's no way. I have to call them Mrs. Smith and so on.
Did you have a high tolerance for noise when you went into the teaching profession?
That's a good question. I think certain teachers have different tolerance levels. I probably have a little more of a tolerance than some of my colleagues. And you can tell if you walk into a classroom and that teacher has the lights off and it's quiet most of the time, that teacher probably doesn't have a high tolerance for noise. However, in teaching primary kids, and maybe that's one of the reasons I do teach primary, is that I have more of a tolerance for noise because, let's face it, they're children, and you don't want them sitting at their desks all day being quiet. That's not how they're going to learn. They need to be up and fiddling with the motors and the everything. They need to be up and moving.
I have four kids myself, and I have been surprised to discover all the times when you have to discipline them for something that you think is really secretly very funny, but you can't let on. I have to imagine that happens to you all the time.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the kids are saying it, and it's not just with discipline, but they're just saying and doing the funniest things. In fact, that is the reason that I wrote the book, Chris, is because after 25 years of hearing the kids saying and doing the darndest things, that saying is so true, I decided, I need to just write this down. People aren't going to believe the funny things they do and say. And that's why I wrote it, because I had all of this material, and I thought, this needs to be in a book. And I'll give you an example. Just a couple of months ago, back in June, I had a student named Giovanna, and she wanted to be a singer more than anything, really knew what she wanted to be. And I had a book on my desk, and I can't remember the title, but the publisher was McGraw-Hill. And when she saw that, she screamed and pointed to that book. I said, "What's wrong, honey?" And she said, "I didn't know that Tim McGraw and Faith Hill wrote a book together." And I thought, that is the cutest thing I've ever heard. I'd never even made the connection between McGraw-Hill and Tim and Faith. So, that's the kind of things they do. And also, related to why I'm still teaching after so many years, I really believe that if teachers in the profession do not lose sight of that and continue to delight in the children, that's what keeps you young and that's what keeps you in the profession. There's a huge turnover. I heard recently that most teachers don't last after 5 years.
Yeah.
And I can see why. You can get jaded. It's a never-ending job, just never-ending. But if you can just delight in the kids, like I'm sure it's the same as with you as a parent, you know, with four kids, as you say, you got to be able to see the charm of what they say and do. If you lose sense of that, it's just going to be frustrating.
Well, some days you calculate when they graduate from high school and go off to college, and then other
exactly.
days you delight in it. Yeah,
exactly. And there's some days that, you know, the Walmart position looks really good to me. but fortunately, those days aren't, you know, you don't have those days all the time.
So 25 years is such an awesome amount of experience to be able to bring into the classroom. And clearly there must be things about the way you approach your work that are more refined and developed now. Is there anything that you think you might have lost as you've gotten older, a certain kind of energy that you had when you were 23 years old and trying to do this?
Oh, very good question. You know, have I lost anything? Well, certainly, I'll answer that, but certainly you gain certain things.
Sure.
Really gain in the patience because you can't do this. This job requires the patience of Job without developing your patience. And you also you learn the importance of humor. That sustains you, keeping a sense of humor. And thirdly, the children teach you to really stop and smell the roses. Imagine, you know, you're walking 30 kids to the cafeteria, and they all stop abruptly when there's a snail on the ground. It forces you to see the details in life. But as far as your question goes about what I've lost, you do your energy level changes. You know, it takes more energy now to do the things that I want to do than it did when I first started 25 years ago. You know, I started in my early 20s, and now I'm in my mid-40s. However, the good teachers will still want to teach the lessons in the same dynamic way, so you still want to have the same energy levels, so it just takes more work to get it, and you probably end up going home and crashing more, but I've noticed the energy levels. That's the main thing.
I know that kids run to school and tell their teachers all kinds of interesting facts about their families.
Yep.
I wonder what you do on parent night when you've heard a story about someone's mom or dad, and then suddenly you sit down and look this person in the eye, and that's all you can think about.
Oh, you are absolutely right. There's an old saying, you know, that teachers use, you know, only believe 50% of what I hear about you, and you only believe 50% of what you hear about me.
Right.
And I tell my parents that at back to school night. But that said, Chris, I don't think the parents really get how much I know about them. Honestly, especially with the little ones, they tell you everything, absolutely everything. You know, if mom was crying last night because of her, you know, her hair color was too dark, they tell you.
Mm-hmm.
If dad was sleeping on the couch, you know, mom and dad had an argument, they tell you. If, you know, mother-in-law got upset because, you know, dad made a comment about her Jell-O salad, they tell you. I mean, really, they tell you everything. And so you're right. You're sitting there at parent-teacher conference, which is about now, come November, first round. And, you know, you just smile. And well, sometimes they will ask you questions about you. Is it true that da-da-da-da-da-da-da, kids go home and report about you as well? And if they pull that on me, if they start asking me things that are embarrassing,
mm-hmm.
I'll say, hey, you know, I know a couple of things about you, too. And then they stop.
Have you had to develop just as much patience for dealing with parents at those conferences and other times as you have for dealing with the kids?
Yes. They say that the hardest part of the job is the parents. And this is nothing against parents. I love my parents. I couldn't do my job without parents. And 95% of the parents are fantastic. But every year you do get one or two doozies. That's what I call them. And yes, they don't train you in teacher school. They can't. You're not dealing with parents in teacher training. But that's the hard part of the job. When you think about it, you've got your 25 kids, but then you have 50 parents that all came from different educational backgrounds, that all have an idea of what a third grade education should look like. And what I tell my new teachers and my student teachers, which you were asking about earlier, is don't try to please them all. You can't. And rule of thumb, if you can please 90%, this is a rule of thumb for all teachers, and it's well known, if you can please 90% of your parents, you're doing well. And I have to remind myself of that. Even after 25 years, you know, I'll get a parent who thinks I'm giving too much homework, or a parent who thinks I'm not giving enough, and you just can't please them all. I have to tell you a funny story quickly. Speaking of a doozy, you know, sometimes I'm asked, well, you know, explain a doozy of a parent. Okay. I was teaching math, and a parent comes to my door and knocks on the classroom door, which is very unusual. Parents usually don't just come in the middle of the day. And I opened the door, and I said, yes, could I help you? And she said to me, she said, my son just sent me a psychic envelope and needs to speak with me. That is the dang truth. And I just stared at her.
It is California.
Like, you are kidding. And I wasn't going to make a scene. I told the son, okay, go talk to your mom. I should have said the post office is closed today. Come back at 3. But, yeah, you get all kinds. And it's the parents that make it challenging.
Mm-hmm. So what do you feel like on the last day of the school year when you've just gotten these 25 little souls to where you want them?
The last day is always very hard for me. And I tell my parents about 3 weeks before, I send a letter out to the parents saying, it's not easy for me to let the birdies out of the nest. You know, imagine, you know, parents get, 18 years to get ready to kick them out of the nest and send them to college. You know, the teachers have them for 185 days, and then, boom, they're not yours anymore. And it's tough. If you've really loved these kids and cared for these kids and invested in these children with all of your energies, come the last few weeks of school, it's really hard to say goodbye to these kids because you know that next year they're going to have their new favorite teacher, and they should. Every year should be the new favorite teacher. But it's difficult, and so on the last day of school, I usually cry. I usually lose it. Now, there have been a couple of years where I didn't. But usually, you know, I'll start tearing up, and then, of course, the kids kind of want you to, and they point and go, you're crying, you're crying, you're crying. And so, yeah, it's always hard for me. And then, you know, once the door closes, you know, I have a good cry. And a lot of teachers, they won't tell you this, but once the door closes on the last day, they don't go out and meet the parents right away because they're crying.
The new book by educator and author Philip Doan is called Close Encounters of a Third Grade Kind, Thoughts on Teacherhood. Phil, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.